and welcome to another episode of PhD Pending, the podcast for early career humanities scholars. My name is Anamala and I have a PhD in English literature. Together, we will deep dive into different aspects of PhD life and explore what it really means to do a PhD in the humanities. My guest today does not need any introduction. Welcome back to the show, Aideen Regan, our former co-host. How have you been?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. Nearly. I'm getting there. The thesis is nearly completely finished. Second round of edits, so that's good. And hopefully submit before end of June officially. So yeah.
Amazing. And in today's episode, Aideen and I want to talk about a topic that I personally haven't really seen addressed anywhere yet. Something that should get way more attention though, and that is dealing with a chronic illness while doing your PhD. Of course, we're giving a little disclaimer because every chronic illness, every experience is different and there's no right or wrong. But of course, we want to share your experience, Aideen, and maybe just to get us started, can you tell us a bit of like the context and the background and what were kind of your steps to realize, okay, so I'm actually dealing with a chronic illness. What was that like?
Even now, when you sent me the script for this episode and it said dealing with a chronic illness, like my first reaction was, oh, that sounds a bit dramatic, you know, which is very typical. Particularly I think in women's healthcare, it's like, oh, you're just very dramatic, take a few paracetamol, etc. Which for someone dealing with a chronic illness, they're like sweets. So I suppose it started probably back in 2015. I started getting really bad pains at random times. Never seemed to be any kind of general timing that matched up. You know, there was no kind of sequence there. And then I ended up in hospital with it, and I was missing a lot of work, and I was someone who'd worked for years and never really missed work. Especially, I mean, there was a period where I had really bad migraines and stuff, but all of that makes sense now. I had never been someone who consistently, you know, I would say 2 days out of every week there for about 6 months in early 2016, I was having to call in sick to work. And that's extremely damaging on your mental health because you feel like everyone's talking about you. You know people are talking about you. And it's very hard when you know that that's not what you're like. And yet, you know, something's going on and no one can figure out what's going on. I was in lucky enough to have the NHS at the time, so it didn't cost me money to keep going to the doctors and being like, what's wrong? Run tests. And eventually I ended up actually being admitted to hospital. And at the time they thought it was a stomach ulcer that had burst and that they just so happened to find a cyst while they were there. So I was monitored for every second month. I had to go and get scans, generally ultrasounds. And then eventually then they found a few more cysts. But never at any point did anyone tell me I had PCOS. And to my knowledge, I still don't have PCOS, even though I would be a classic case for it. So generally with PCOS, you're a little overweight. You have consistent, you know, pain in your periods, but not to the extremes, I suppose, I was experiencing is the problem. And multiple cysts and issues with your periods. Now, I didn't have issues with my periods other than the agony I was in. And it wouldn't be generally at a certain time of the month either. It would be just at random, which is, of course, again, debilitating mentally because you could be in work in the middle of the day and have great time and be on the ball. And then all of a sudden you're like doubled over and like trying to catch a cold tile on the floor of the university and hoping, you know, that something will ease it. And then eventually, anyway, long story short, I kind of had enough of it. I'd gone into hospital again. And I was waiting for 3 days and they said it was too close. I had a big cyst and it was too close to one of my ovaries that if they went and got it, they'd nick it and it could compromise the whole ovary. So what happened was I kind of was monitored again and instead they started bringing me in every 4 weeks to monitor it. And to be fair, they're lovely. They were amazing. The whole surgical team down here in Clonmel were amazing. But I don't have healthcare. Even though it's cheap enough in Ireland, and I'm conscious of American listeners that when I talk about prices later in the episode, they might be like, seriously, that's my iced coffee, you know, for the month. But, you know, obviously I was still paying quite a lot of money in fees every month. I'm already living at home to save money. I spend a fortune on petrol every month getting to work. So it was a lot of money to me to have to be spending to go up and down to Clonmel all the time, get these scans done, etc. Hospital stay as well, you know, it could be 180 a night. Again, very conscious it's not the end of the world, but eventually I went to a fertility specialist because I was actually getting quite frustrated and I was getting a little worried that maybe there was more going on that they couldn't see unless they went in surgically, which was exactly what they said, that unless they go in surgically, but then they couldn't go in surgically. So I went to a fertility specialist. So if you are worried, I wouldn't advise it. It cost me €280. But that was for all the bloods, for several visits, for a consultation, for a scan, and they were able to diagnose me, and they were happy to put it in writing. Now, that's usually you hear people only get diagnosed with endometriosis, which is what I have, if it's been diagnosed surgically, and that is generally the way they do go because at least they can see the tissue there and how big it is and how far it goes, but it just wasn't an option for me, so I had to go and do this instead, and I was very glad I did because he put it in writing for me as well. He was able to see that this type of cyst I have, you can only get if you have endometriosis. It's what they call a chocolate cyst. Not as fun as it sounds. So yeah, so that would have been then. So we'll say from 2015, and it took till July 2021, and that would be about the average. I think it's about 5 to 8 years is kind of the average it takes to get diagnosed with endometriosis because people just don't know about it. Even I didn't know about it. I didn't know it existed. So, yeah.
There's very little awareness around it, and I feel like around chronic illnesses in general, obviously you can't generalize too much, but I feel like especially when it comes to women's health, there's still a taboo around it. What you were saying earlier about, oh, just throw some paracetamol at the problem, you know, like don't be hysteric. I feel like there's still a bit of a stigma around it, and that's probably why nobody really knows about it. But then when we think about the mental health impact that has, and you're trying to, you know, work at the same time, and obviously it spreads the process of you suffering from it and then trying to find a solution and going to all those doctors. Like all of this happened across the span of your PhD, right? So the mental health impact and all of that and the symptoms, how did that affect your PhD life and your research life?
So, in terms of the research, I was very lucky that my supervisors were extremely understanding. Before I ever got the diagnosis, I just kind of said, "Look, I'm having a really tough time here. I could do 12 hours one day, and then I might have to go to bed after an hour the next day, and it's very frustrating." And they were very understanding about it, and we're just like, "You're meeting your deadlines. Don't be worrying. And if you need extra time, you have it, like to move around with. So make the most of it." I was also very lucky that when my symptoms significantly worsened was during the pandemic. And I'm not quite sure why that was, but they do think that actually there's very little studies on it, but they do think that because I had 2 year gap there where I didn't really have much between my master's, where I was in hospital, and then suddenly I was okay for 2 years and I was very busy, as I said before in this podcast, I was working full time separate to the PhD. And I was fine and I was able to get to work, no problem, no issues. But they reckon that it's actually soya can help ease symptoms. And because I was already vegan, well, I went vegan at that time when I started my PhD about a year in, I think that's why I got away with it.
Because there's natural estrogen in soy, isn't there?
So it was almost doing the work of the pill. So
Yeah.
now, no, don't use it as a contraceptive. I'm just saying, in terms of the chemicals, yes, it works the same. Because that's the thing they said to me is the only cure we have at the moment, and it's not a cure, it's a management, is the pill, which I wasn't keen on because I had been on it briefly when I was younger. I'd gained a load of weight within 2 months, and I also had like went significantly psycho on it, and I didn't like it. So I was very conscious of that, but actually this time it was fine, and I gained a bit of weight, but that's very, very little concern compared to what I was dealing with before. So yeah, so I think it was the every day of being frustrated where you would genuinely be on the ball, you'd be really in the zone, which is hard to get in the PhD, to be on a roll with something and be excited and feel like, oh, I'm nearly there, I can get this chapter bashed out by in 2 weeks' time, and then all of a sudden it's like boom, bed for 4 days, vomiting, crawling on the pain, like floor in pain, getting codeine and not even being enough. And yeah, it was very frustrating. I was very lucky in terms of the work alongside the PhD that my boss was extremely accommodating, but I will say that had I not liked my job, had I not enjoyed my research, there's no way, there is absolutely no way I could have gone through with it because it's extremely hard. It's a pain I've never felt before. Nothing seems to fix it. You might get a bit of relief if you go into a hot bath with Epsom salts for a little while, but it's just the most horrific form of pain. It really is because there's nothing you can do and no one believes you is the problem. And even my boyfriend was really shocked at times when he kind of saw just how bad it was and could see me on the phone crying to the doctors and them just being like, there's nothing I can give you. I've given you the strongest I can. You know, I'm really sorry. Do you want to go to A&E? But I know if I go to A&E, they'll turn me away because once they see that there's nothing, there's no ovary twisted, they'll just send you home because that's the only thing they'll deal with. And I remember, you know, at various times just getting up, feeling fine that morning. And then, you know, obviously my boyfriend was working from home as well. And just like run to the bathroom and just vomiting and crying and vomiting and crying and repeat over and over again and just nothing would help. And it is extremely hard to concentrate or do even the most minimal tasks when you're in that state. So I'm very lucky that I had the supervisor I had, that I had the boss I had. Even for ourselves, Anne, when we were recording sometimes, you know, I'd have to go, lads, I'm so sorry, and we'd all be set up and I'd be like, I physically can't record, you know. So yeah, it definitely has a day-to-day impact, and of course the mental impact that comes along with that. It's just a deep frustration, you know, that you're like, I am not in a bad mental state. I want to do this work, or I want to go meet my friends, or I want to go on that trip, but you're constantly worried that it's just going to erupt out of nowhere and it's invisible, so people don't really get it, you know. Whereas if my leg just started falling off or went on fire in front of people, they believe something was wrong. But when you're just sitting there couched over, it's like, oh, you know, when you feel it yourself, because especially after years of being told by doctors, or you know, you heard people around you kind of having an opinion, you start to believe that it is in your head a bit. So that's the one thing I will say is go get the diagnosis, because I felt so vindicated, and the imp it was so good for my mental health to have someone say, I'm putting this in writing. Yeah, it definitely feels awkward to even call it a chronic illness, but it is. Like, I think back to those times. I'm great now because of the medication I'm on. But like, when I think back to those times, I just cannot believe I was able to work. You know what I mean? I was able to get anything done. It's bizarre looking back.
It's to me, and obviously I've seen it from the outside, the impact that it had on you, and it was really only watching it from the sidelines. I was never really in the midst of it, but just the idea of suffering from this pain, going through these random, like the scary thing to me is that there was no clock on it, right? It could just happen and, you know, ruin your entire day, week, whatever, right? And that to me, just like you never know when it happens. And that to me is so scary. And then not knowing what it is would just freak me the fuck out. And I don't know how you even dealt with that for so long. And I just completely understand this, like it must have been such a weight off your shoulders to finally have a name on it, to have a label on it, to know what it is, and then, you know, you can actually do something about it instead of just, you know, stabbing around in the dark trying to find out what it is, right?
And it was funny actually, because to be fair to my surgical team, like they were just, I can't get over. I remember going in for a consultation, and this was during one of my particularly bad episodes, was when I got the consultation for the gynecological unit down in Clonmel, which is the best in Munster. And I went in for the, but of course that's no use to me, because by the time I went in for the consult, I wasn't in the middle of a flare up, so he was just kind of like, well, explain to me. And so I gave him a list, and I think it was the end of January, and I gave him a list that I'd written down every symptom, every date, and he didn't even read it. He flipped it over back and forth, and he goes, okay, let's just bring you in because this is ridiculous. And he was just so good. And even though I was there for 3 days or 4 days in the hospital, and I was getting very anxious because it was COVID, it was scary. I wasn't vaccinated at the time. And
But it also took such a significant chunk, not even the levels of pain that you're in and the mental fallout of all of that, but also all the doctor's appointments, the times you couldn't work, the times you were in the hospital. That was so much work time that was cut from you know, your research and teaching and all of that stuff. So obviously we talked about our my former, your still boss, Kathy, and your supervisors. But did you approach the apartment about any accommodation in terms of like sick leave, any kind of fee waivers for the time that you were out sick, that you had a med cert? Did you approach it in an admin way that helped you maybe ease the burden a small bit in terms of like the pressure of, okay, I need to pay another round of fees for a new term, but I was only able to work for so and so many weeks the other term? Did you do anything about that? How was the department? How was the college with that?
That's an excellent question, and it's something I would recommend people to do. I didn't, but mine was purely out of stubbornness, and also because I had taken me so long to get to such a good place with my project that I wasn't willing to let it go. And I was afraid if I took the extra time, I'd end up, you know, pissing about with it. So my supervisor, I kind of said to them, they had offered, they were like, if you ever need leave, like, you know, just come to us, we can just talk about it. But I was very much like, if you're happy for me to work as much as I can when I can, I would like to do that. Now, in terms of the fee waiver, I absolutely should have done that, because it was crazy money every month that I was paying. And really, I only got my fees paid a bit early because of the pandemic. I wasn't spending money on petrol because we weren't allowed to go anywhere. So yeah, otherwise I'd still probably be paying off my fees, you know. But I definitely think I would have lost at least about 6 months there of time if I tried to calculate it all up over the year and a half that I had significantly bad symptoms. I would say I lost about 6 months.
That's a third.
Yeah, it's a lot. But I remember also needing it for my mental health. Now, if I had had kids, if I had, you know, caring responsibilities or anything, if I didn't live at home, I probably would have had to, because I wouldn't have had a choice, because I would have had to just work the times that I was able to and not do the PhD. But I was lucky enough in my situation. So I genuinely needed it for my mental health, because I wasn't going back to that place where I was missing work, you know, as I had a few years before. And just sitting staring at the walls, going really mentally downhill, feeling like an absolute waste of space. Like, I wasn't having that. But yeah, so I remember being really fed up, and it was at the time the hostel was on a shutdown because there were so many cases of COVID. So I wasn't allowed visitors or anything, but I wouldn't have liked visitors anyway. I'm not really someone who's in the form, you know. I'm sure many people aren't, but you know, when you see people coming in, but I just would be like, leave me alone, like, just leave me be. So my mom actually dropped down my laptop and some additional clothes because I didn't expect to be checked in. So I actually did a load of work when I was in the hospital, and it was amazing. Like, it really, because even the nurses came in, and I remember at one point, like, I was just kind of upset. Like, I wasn't like wailing or anything, you know, but I was kind of upset and I was fed up and I just wanted to go home. I was like, if they're not going to take it out, what am I doing here? She came in, she's like, do you want me to give you something? Like, basically said it. She was like, just, you might sleep better. And I was like, no, I'm fine. Can I get my laptop? And she was like, yeah, okay. So, and I sat there and I literally was like a new person. She came in the next day and she was like, geez, you're perky. And I just worked through the night on my laptop, done some editing for my chapter, and I just felt miles better. So that was kind of a sign to me of, you need this to keep you going, even though weirdly, like, obviously I'm reading the most depressing stuff for my research and, you know, talking about mothers murdering their children and, you know, people committing suicide with the fairies and, you know, it's all this depressing stuff. But I was honestly so uplifting. I really enjoyed the process. So no, I didn't. Yeah. But I would absolutely say, if, you know, I was very fortunate and kind of all the circumstances very much allowed me to keep working. If you're someone who doesn't have that kind of privilege, I suppose, absolutely go and speak to your supervisors, because that was the what I was told was the first port of call. You go to your supervisors first, they'll tell you what kind of options are there, and then they'll direct you to whoever you need to go to. Absolutely, I think if you're someone that isn't sure how it'll affect you, better safe than sorry. If you end up taking the leave but work, being able to work, great, you'll be ahead of yourself by the time you come back. But there's no need. Now, I will say I did get the general extension that they gave to all PhDs eventually of the extra 9 months with no fees because of COVID. So I technically kind of did, but I didn't apply on medical grounds for it. So I was stupid. I actually forgot about it. I was trying to think of excuses. And it was only when you just said it there, I was like, I had the perfect excuse to apply for that, and I just was there trying to think of, well, there was this resource I couldn't access in the
And you know, it just strikes me as something, it's almost like you took back control, especially when you were in the hospital and everything is so out of your hands, right? But the one thing that you could do was, and that is part of your identity, right? It's your research and it's your PhD and being able to have that almost as an escapism, even though, like, I'm aware it's still work, but at the same time, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like you have that bit of yourself protected and you can access that. And it's almost like your little secret garden where your research is and your PhD is. And, you know, it's in your hands to do something. So I really love that.
Yeah, no, it was
That's.
definitely very cathartic. And like you
Yeah.
said, it's even though it's work, it's almost like it's kind of like, you know, in the I'm not trying to equate the stresses of a PhD to being a business owner, but you know, it's almost like, well, this is mine, and if I don't take care of it, no one will. So it's a good
Yeah.
excuse. Same way, you know, when you know I had a pretty tough week the last few weeks, and I had the dog there. And I was like, I can't really, even if I wanted to, go into like a wallow of self-pity because that dog needs to be brought on 3 walks a day, even though he's like 3 inches high. He like he just insists upon it. So you can't really afford to fall down into kind of a bad mental health hole when you have things like that waiting for you. So the PhD was great in that way. Obviously, it can cause mental health issues. We've talked about that a million times before.
Million
But I
times.
actually found it my saving grace, to be honest. It was really, I was really lucky I had it, because if I'd just had a regular 9 to 5, I don't think I would have been able to stay motivated to kind of get back to work and stuff.
I never thought about the PhD as, you know, almost like a bit of a mental health saver in a situation like that. But it's actually it's really nice to not think about the PhD as a problem, but a bit like it's very rare. And we lightly touched on, you know, the financial impact that had, not in terms of fees, but in terms of medical bills.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'm aware that it's different here in Ireland to the States, to the UK, to Germany. I just pay a flat fee every month for my health insurance. I'm legally obliged to have health insurance. Obviously, it's different in the States. In the UK, you have the NHS and you don't pay anything. It's all state funded. Here, everything is like somewhat optional and it's still mental to me. I know at the start of lockdown, I had to go in for an MRI scan of my knee. And I remember you texting me saying, "Oh my God, how are you going to pay for it? How much was it?" And I'm like, I've never seen a medical bill in my life. Like, I would not. I actually had to Google it. I was like, okay, so a scan of a knee, like, how much would that be? Not a fucking notion, right? So I'm aware that all the health systems are different. But even just in terms of coming up with the funds to get all the bloods done, to see the specialist, to afford being able to stay in the hospital, to me it's a foreign concept. But like, how did you manage to, you know, work through that extra financial burden that you had because of it?
Well, there were, yeah, it was a few things, and again, I was very lucky that, you know, if that had even happened, if I had been in this situation, even when we'll say when I was a manager in a call center, I was living in Cork City Centre. It was extremely expensive. It wasn't as expensive as it is now, but it was extremely expensive. And even though I was on good money, it was all going on fees or savings for the masters. I would have absolutely been screwed, 1,000,000%. And even though I've been lucky with how much I've had to pay, so we'll say for every doctor's appointment, I was paying about 60 euro. For painkillers, I was maybe paying another 40 euro a month. To the point where then, I don't know if I should say this legally. There's a family member I have who has a standing order of pain medication that I needed to literally fucking beg for. So I just used theirs after a while. Totally. And then, like, how do you even estimate the amount of hours missed out on? Because as I said, I was very lucky that Kathy worked with me, and where possible, you know, my hours could be rescheduled if it was admin. Or, you know, we could do a swap with another tutor so that I didn't have to lose out on hours. But there were still times where I couldn't, you know, at all at work. You know, it was rare that I couldn't find some way around it. But you know, I can't even count it. I would say hundreds, like I would say hundreds in the year and a half where it got very significantly serious. And then of course petrol up and down to Clonmel every month. You know, it's a lot, it adds up over time, and I was just very lucky where I lived, and I don't have health insurance. So if it had gotten any more serious, like when I got kind of told the story, I was given a list of fees from the surgical department. And it would have been between anywhere between, depending on how the surgery went, it could be anywhere between $2,500 to $8,000 for my surgery. So, you know, it's...
That's more than we make in a year as PhDs.
And then,
really?
And then the fertility specialist is nearly 300, but it was worth every penny. But for, again, for that, now that was something I could preempt. That was a cost I could preempt, which was great, as was the going up and down to my scans. So I was able to ensure at the start of the month when I was putting some money into savings and I was paying my fees, that I had set aside money for petrol and things like that.
It's kind of, you know, it's a really tough topic to talk about, and I'm really grateful that you're that open and that you want to share all that stuff. But even for someone listening who might be a man, right, and dealing with another chronic illness, I know it's very specific, but there's a couple of things that like strike me as, okay, you can definitely apply that to another case.
And
having said that, like, do you have any recommendations for people dealing with chronic illness on top of their PhDs, or people who are going through this journey towards a diagnosis and they don't really know what's wrong? Do you have any kind of recommendations?
Yeah, I think try think outside the box a bit. So in terms of your daily management, even if you're someone that's like, oh, well, you know, going for a walk never helped me, or, you know, well, I never really liked baths, or, well, I never really took a painkiller, so why would I take it now? It's like, if you are in that much pain, if it's any more than inconvenient pain, you need something. Whether you go and get holistic stuff, whether you take medicine, whatever you need, like, don't be a martyr for no reason. Do you know, like, it's not necessary. The other thing is, if you are finding that, you know, do what you can when you can. Obviously, we've already talked about, you know, first protocol, go see if it's feasible. If you feel like you really wouldn't be able to work through it, then of course there's other ways to do it. Go about it, go to your supervisors. But for example, if there were times where I just really needed the mental energy to be directed somewhere else other than in my head about, you know, what is going on, etc., and how am I going to keep doing this for the rest of my life? Like, is this my life now? It won't be. It'll come in waves, and I think that's the same with every chronic illness. There will be periods where it's significantly worse than others.
Yeah.
So make the most of the days that it's not, and still ensure, like, to do your research, make the most of it, bang through it as much as you can, enjoy the fact that you actually are able to concentrate without, you know, this flare up, you know, interrupting it. But also, if there are times where you feel like, oh no, it's coming, have some idea in your head, like, you'll notice patterns of not, you know, flare-ups. It's kind of whenever it feels like it. But if I noticed that it was coming, I could feel it coming on, I knew I was starting to feel ill, I was starting to feel a bit nauseous, I knew that I was starting to get, I got really bad tingles and pains in my legs, and my ankles would swell up. Apparently that can be if the endometriosal tissue is on a certain vein. I don't know enough about it, and I think a lot of people don't know enough about it anyway, doctors included. So, but yeah, my whole ankles would just fill up with water and stuff, and so I knew when I was sitting at the desk within about half an hour, I'm going to be in agony. So I would go straight into the Epsom salt bath, and I'd bring one of maybe my research with me, whether I print off a few articles or a book, and I'd relax and just accept it.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. Accept it. Like, you can fight it to a certain extent, and I absolutely did for months. I'd be like, no, I'm getting up. I'm not missing this session. I'm strapping this hot water bottle to my back. And it's great if you can do that, but sometimes you just need to give in and accept that you're not going to do the work you planned that day, but maybe you can do something else, if only for your own head's sake. But at the same time, don't feel bad if there's days where you're really not able, because there's times when I was in bed, and even someone, you know, my boyfriend was like, just watch a film, like, just relax. And even having a Netflix film on while I was in bed and, you know, strapped up and painkillers out was too much. I couldn't even bear the sound of anything. You know, I just wanted to black out. I just wanted to go sleep and just be done. So just ride the waves and suit yourself as needs be. Like, don't keep pushing it. You'll end up hating your work. You'll end up, you know, going down a very bad path mentally, I think. So just work with yourself. You know, it's not your body's fault.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've had to learn the hard way as well that, like, your health is your wealth and so is your mind. So you need to, and it sounds very cringy, but honestly, I'm also very aware that, you know, I could have far worse things. So there's no point beating myself up about this. it's manageable. I know what it is now. You just have to work with it, and there's no point cursing your body, or you know, it's just what it is, and it's not its fault, and you know, feel sorry for it, but make it get up and make it get going. And days where I could go for a walk, I made myself go, even though I really didn't want to. Again, you even remember yourself, I'd go off and ring you while I was on a walk and just rant about everything and anything, whether it was a show or something, just take my mind off it, because I knew once I got back I'd be confined to the bed, and I'd be at least glad that I got out and got some air, you know.
Yeah.
So just don't let yourself get into a dark place where you're just staring at all four walls. And don't let people talk about it either. It's business about yours. So if they're worried,
exactly,
that's different. But if they're, you're getting comments, like, don't be afraid to tell people to fuck off. I should have told way more people to fuck off. And that's my mantra for life, really. To be honest, I should have told way more people to fuck off when I wasn't happy.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Aideen, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all these stories with us and your experiences. Just real quick, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Oh God, I always get this wrong. I think my Twitter is eregan1991.
It is.
My Instagram is Aideen Lee Regan, but it's in Irish, so we'll just link it.
We'll link it below, as always. Thank you very much for sharing all your wisdom with us. And obviously, again, we're aware that, you know, this is a very specific experience. But hopefully, if you're dealing with something similar, you took some positive messages out of this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks, Aideen, for taking the time to come back on. If you're dealing with a chronic illness, we'd love to hear more about your experiences. And if you have any tips, hop on our social media on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod, or you can write me an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com if you have a specific question for Aideen. If you enjoyed the episode, you can consider donating to our Buy Me a Coffee page so we can keep creating content for you. And we also have a Patreon, and we will see you again in 2 weeks' time. Thanks. This episode of PhD Pending was written and produced by me, Anne Mahler. Artwork by Jerome Kelleher. Support the show and rate us 5 stars in your favorite podcast app. You can also subscribe to our Patreon for exclusive bonus content, or if you prefer a once-off donation, head to our Buy Me a Coffee page. The links to both are in the show notes. You can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod, or send an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com.